Hello, I'm Mike Mendel. This is number 0103, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0103. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Pete Trabuco, who is the author of America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks. So, what does he prefer, wooden or steel roller coasters?
Well, the wood coasters are obviously, there's some new ones that are coming out that are very smooth, but steel coasters are obviously what I go for, because you can go higher and faster and do all those loop-de-loop elements, all those elements that mimic aerobatic flying.
Tom Seto is a Hollywood animator and the author of Drawing the Line and also Timing for Animation. He believes animation is finally getting the respect it deserves among adults.
That huge baby boom generation was raised on animation in the 1950s and 60s. It just got this attitude of that animation was just babysitter, it was just baby food. In other countries, like in Japan and Europe and all, the graphic novel was considered just another part of literature. While in America, it all just seemed like, oh, it's just for kids. And that attitude has only recently finally sort of, you know, gone away.
Jeffrey Gurian is a dentist who is also a comedian and a comic writer.
While I was in practice, I was writing for Joan Rivers and Rodney Dangerfield and for the Friars Roast and for legends like Milton Berle and Henny Youngman and people like that and Jerry Lewis. And they would call me at the office, and my nurse knew only interrupt me when there is someone in show business on the phone. So she would come in, she'd say, Dr. Rivers is calling, you know. Dr. Lewis is on the phone for you. The only one that no one believed was Dr. Dangerfield.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0103, was Mike Mendel, who is president and managing director of Global NTT. He's a show promoter. And by the way, he's bringing Warren G as a tribute to Nate Dogg here in Montreal. You can check out his website or Facebook page to find out more information, and you can find those links by going to thestufffile.com. And I thank you very much, Mike, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, here's a little life tip for you. If you're going to go around riding your bike while carrying an axe and covered in your own blood, the police are going to want to talk to you. That was the scene in Peterborough, Ontario, here in Canada, where police arrested 41-year-old Lawrence Alfred Carnite while, yes, bike riding downtown with an axe in his hand, covered in his own blood. Police are still trying to sort out the chaos, but they have confirmed that there's no victim involved in the incident. Carnite has been charged with publicly carrying dangerous weapons. This really isn't much of a shocker for local police, as Mr. Carnite has an extensive criminal record and is well known by officers and the local judicial system. He also has a history of drug addiction. Charged with publicly carrying a dangerous weapon. Interesting. So, what if you had to chop down a tree, but you didn't have a car? Public transit is kind of out of the question, but you can't use a bike to carry an axe? I guess not. Anyway, 55-year-old Rodney Harmon of Sacramento said he visited the Hilton Garden Inn Sonoma County Airport back in March and found a copy of USA Today outside his door. He assumed it was complimentary, so he took it in. But then he was billed 75 cents for the paper and turned into a very angry man. He's now filed a federal class action lawsuit against the hotel chain, saying he was deceived by a scheme that also hurts the environment. Harmon accused Hilton of deliberately hiding the newspaper charge by describing the fee in an extremely small font, which is difficult to notice or read on the sleeve of the room card. The suit noted that most hotel guests probably aren't reading the paper anyway, and the wasted papers are an offensive waste of precious resources and energy, and that deforestation caused by paper production is a matter of concern and worry in this state, country, and worldwide. Wow. Kirk Walden, who is Harmon's attorney, said, Certainly, if people who don't want newspapers are getting newspapers and then not using them, that is a waste that we don't need. Hilton isn't commenting, but we have a feeling we know exactly what they're thinking. So let's just move on, shall we? For his 85th birthday this year, Gary Lenzer decided to do something incredible and jumped out of a plane at 10,000 feet, free-falling for about 40 seconds before landing safely by parachute on Nichols Field in Jammu, which is east of San Diego. But this was no ordinary jump. Mr. Lenzer is a Holocaust survivor who escaped a World War II concentration camp and says the experience was a way to prove Adolf Hitler couldn't put out his flame. Lenzer said, "I'd like to prove the SOB didn't succeed. Not only didn't he succeed, I had 2 children, 8 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren, and now I'm jumping out of an airplane." Lenzer's skydiving dream had been nearly a decade in the making and was carefully planned to prevent certain family members from finding out in advance. Those who would, as Lenzer put it, have gone crazy had they found out. Well, you go, Grandpa. Good on you. And a great way to show up, Adolf. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest on the program, we always thought that Dunkin' Donuts already had enough sugar, but in Rockaway, New Hampshire, 29-year-old Dunkin' Donuts employee Melissa Redman has been arrested for offering customers some extra sugar with their orders. Through an anonymous tip, police discovered Redman, who worked the night shift, was allegedly taking breaks from selling donuts and coffee to provide sexual services in exchange for money. Detectives noticed on multiple evenings that she would go out to cars to see customers and would spend 10 or 15 minutes there. Sometimes they'd even see money change hands. Redman has since been arrested and charged with prostitution. Okay, not that I want to be stereotypical here, but if you're going to commit the crime of prostitution, or any crime for that matter, on a regular basis, don't you think it would behoove you to do it someplace other than a donut shop? Actually, I'm not being stereotypical here. Let's be honest. Cops go to donut shops, and no, it's not necessarily to eat donuts. It's a 24-hour outlet that also sells coffee. That's why cops go. Someone who works there would definitely know that. I swear, for that reason alone, I almost made her the idiot of the day, but that comes later. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Pete Trabuco is a travel expert and also a bit of a thrill seeker. He is the author of America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks, and he joins us on the line right now. Hi, Peter.
Hey, good to have me on. Thank you.
Thanks for being on. You go around checking out roller coasters. Great gig. First of all, I have to ask, are roller coasters as popular as they always have been, and are the newer ones better or the older ones?
Well, it all depends on who you talk to. There's been a new resurgence for roller coasters and amusement parks, and all you have to do is go to your local park to see the new rides, and 9 times out of 10, there'll be a new ride there. There is a resurgence for these roller coasters, and yes, I do enjoy going to them. I have a great gig in which I'm able to travel around the country, and a lot of times I get to even ride the new roller coasters. Now, as far as the new opposed to the old, well, the wood coasters are obviously, there's some new ones that are coming out that are very smooth. But steel coasters are obviously what I go for, because you can go higher and faster and do all those loop-de-loop elements, all those elements that mimic aerobatic flying. So there's a lot out there. There's so many different types of roller coasters now, and there's one out for just about everyone out there.
We should mention, you're also a pilot, are you not?
Yeah, I'm a pilot, private pilot, and I've done some aerobatic training, so basically roller coasters is not much of a stretch.
Well, I was about to ask, for those who have never done aerobatic flying, how close are roller coasters to that experience?
Pretty close in that basically you're mimicking the actual maneuvers, the Emelmans, the loop-de-loops, the barrel rolls. The only thing is in an airplane you have sustained Gs, whether it's a negative G that almost feels like you're being ejected out of your seat, or a positive G making it feel like you're actually being pushed into your seat. The durations are usually a lot longer when you're flying an airplane, maybe 10, 15, 20 seconds, maybe even longer than that. Whereas on a roller coaster, you get that same feeling, but you only get it for a couple seconds.
What's the average speed of a really good roller coaster?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. The average speed for a really good wood roller coaster right now is between 50 and about 70 miles an hour, and the average speed for a really good steel roller coaster right now is between 70 and 90, although the fastest roller coaster right now is in Abu Dhabi, and that goes 150 miles an hour.
And how are roller coasters affected, especially the wooden ones? Because, you know, we recently had, all through North America, as a matter of fact, most of North America is still in it, a massive heat wave. That has effects on structure. Is this a concern for roller coasters?
Not really. Basically, it depends on, you know, and these manufacturers, they go out of their way to make sure that they're using the right materials in the right locations and so on down the line. You know, wood coasters that seem like wood coasters really aren't, because they've got steel reinforcements in some places, by the Jersey Shore, for example. Great White is a good example. Looks like a wood, but it really is a steel coaster because of the salt buildup. And they're very safe. They police the area really well. Remember, if there's an incident at an amusement park and it's a fatality, that gets in every paper and it affects sales. So they've got to make sure that these things are extremely safe. You have, in fact, a much better chance of actually getting into an incident or an accident, maybe 1,000 times better chance of getting into that, just driving to the park as opposed to actually being in the park and on the ride.
You just brought up an interesting point. You said that there's a roller coaster, some roller coasters that are wood roller coasters are not really wood roller coasters, and there are those enthusiasts who are diehards for either wood or steel. Why are they still making wood roller coasters? What is the lure of that, especially if, as you say, they have steel rods in them and they're not really wood?
Well, that's some of them, basically. A good example of that would be California Screaming, which is over at Disneyland in California Adventure. It looks like a wood coaster, and it's painted like a wood coaster, but it's actually a steel coaster. As far as the enthusiasts concern, American Coaster Enthusiasts, basically is one of the biggest organizations around, about 5,000 or 6,000 members nationwide, worldwide. They prefer mostly a lot of the classic wood coasters as well as the steel coasters. I personally like the steel coasters because they can go faster. They are a little bit smoother. But, you know, it all started with the wood coaster. And the experience you get on a wood coaster, you know, the rickety feeling, you know, the clanking of the sound going up a lift hill, and just the way it's all set up, the cars themselves, is totally different than when you're locked into a steel roller coaster, which reminds me more of being locked in with the astronauts, which I've done in simulation training. It's very similar on a steel coaster because you feel pretty secure and locked in. Whereas on a wood coaster, it's a little bit different, and that's why they both do very well, because people have different likes and dislikes.
So as you say, it sounds like what you're saying with the wooden roller coaster, even though they're all perfectly safe, what seems to be part of the thrill is the slight feeling that there might be danger.
Well, that's in all roller coasters. Obviously, when you go through a queue line and you're looking up at these roller coasters and you see them flying past at 60, 70 miles an hour, it gives the illusion of total danger. You're actually going into an area where basically no people have gone before. And really, that's not the truth. It is a very safe ride. You know, I think aerobatic flying is extremely safe, too, as well, as long as you do it and you perform it correctly. And they do. So it's more of an illusion. If you go in there knowing it's an illusion and that you're going to have some fun and that you're going to be experiencing things that you don't normally experience in daily life, you're going to have a great time.
There are quite a few advances in roller coasters in the last 30, 40 years, and I'm sure you've been a roller coaster enthusiast for quite some time. What are some of the things that roller coasters do now that when you look back to when you first started enjoying roller coasters, you thought, wow, I never saw that coming?
Well, I remember I was afraid of roller coasters. I actually wrote the book to overcome my fear. It was sort of a little therapy to do that. Even though I was a pilot, I had a childhood fear when I was younger. So I had to overcome that. But rides have come a long way. Yeah, the wood roller coasters are still there. They're great. They're fantastic. We've got some real new ones, good ones coming out all over the country. But, you know, and overall, you've got rides now that shoot you straight up. They shoot you from 0 to 150 miles an hour. There is no lift hill. They've actually got braking systems that use magnetics as well as impulse systems and systems that actually shoot you from the start line, you know, which, by the way, the U.S. military as well as NASA looks into for catapulting purposes. These are all using magnets, the technology has gone so far. The whole thing started with the steel coaster, when Walt Disney actually created the Matterhorn over at Disneyland. I believe that was in 1959. And that opened up a whole new arena for how and what you can do with roller coasters. And now, of course, you've got simulation rides that include tracks as well. So, you know, the sky is the limit and the imagination is the limit to what they can do to you now with all these different types of roller coaster rides.
And by the way, for me, for the record, the scariest part was always the lift hill, because it was the anticipation of what are they going to do to me?
Well, this is true. The lift hill is probably the one where you have the most anticipation, and some of the manufacturers know that, and sometimes they make you go up the hill real fast. There's a roller coaster right in my area called Nitro. It's not a chain link. It's actually more of a strap like, and you go up within very quickly. El Toro is the same way. There are a lot of rides out there where they don't really want you on that lift hill too long because they've got so many people that want to go on the ride because it's so busy. They'll flip you up there, and you can get up there in 10, 15, 20 seconds as opposed to the minute that it used to take.
Do you have a favorite ride? And if so, why is it your favorite?
Well, I'm on the cover of my book, America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks, A Guide to Those Who Ride Them and Those Who Fear Them. I have on the cover Millennium Force, which is out of Sandusky, Ohio, in an amusement park called Cedar Point. They've got about 17 of the best rides you'll ever find around the country. Don't get me wrong, I love Disney, and I love Disney World and Busch Gardens and SeaWorld and Six Flags. But that is my ultimate favorite. However, in Montreal, there's some great ones as well, like Le Monstre is a fantastic ride. I was just recently there not too long ago and had an amazing experience. So I guess the answer is the best roller coaster I'm riding is the one I'm riding at that time.
The book is called America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks. It's written by Pete Trabuco, and you can check out the website at americasrollercoasters.tatepublishing.net, correct?
That is correct, yes.
That's americasrollercoasters.tatepublishing.net. I thank you very, very much, Pete, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope to hopefully be visiting your area soon.
Pete Trabuco, author of America's Top Roller Coasters and Amusement Parks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0103, and you'll find links to Pete's website and also links to Amazon.com where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, you'll meet animator and author Tom Cito. Plus, you'll meet comic and dentist, that's right, dentist, Jeffrey Gurian. That's all coming up. Plus, of course, there is an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. But right now, we have more Stuff File news for you. Now, here's your freak of nature story of the day. In India, a father of two has had a hysterectomy. Yes, I said a father. This after doctors found a full female reproductive system in his lower abdomen. A farmer, known only as Rayalu, was admitted to a hospital after complaining of severe stomach pains. Now, doctors suspected a normal hernia, but during an exploratory surgery, they were shocked to discover a full female uterus, ovaries, fallopian tubes, and a cervix. Doctors confirm Rayalu had external male organs and otherwise lived a normal male life. The patient, who was said to be as stunned as his doctors at the discovery, is recovering in hospital and is being supported by his family. I said he was a father of two. Perhaps it's time those two kids either got a paternity test, a complete physical, or both. Okay, try to remember the phrase, everything in moderation. In Britain, 20-year-old Chris Staniforth has literally Xboxed himself to death. Chris reportedly played the game Halo on his Xbox for up to 12 hours at a time and has died from deep vein thrombosis, a condition triggered by sitting for extremely long periods of time. A coroner said that there was a blood clot that formed in his leg that moved up to his lungs and caused a fatal pulmonary embolism. Deep vein thrombosis usually occurs among people who have to sit on long flights, according to the Mayo Clinic. Symptoms include swelling in the leg where the blood clot originates, followed by a shortness of breath, chest pains, and dizziness. Chris's father, David, said, "After my research, I saw there was no difference to Chris sitting at a desk on his Xbox and someone on a long flight." In a statement, Xbox manufacturer Microsoft said that it encourages gamers to take breaks from playing. I believe the accurate translation of Microsoft's statement might be, get a life. Meanwhile, here's some tragic irony for you. In the picturesque Italian Julian Alps, 41-year-old Federico Dean was sprinkling the ashes and saying a final goodbye to his younger brother, who had lost his life in a car crash in June. He chose the location because it was his brother's favorite place to go. Yet, while he was in the process of distributing the ashes, a storm came up and Dean was struck and killed by lightning. He leaves behind a wife and a daughter. Well, that's just God's way of saying, I have a two-for-one sale plan for your family. In Idaho Falls, Idaho, 34-year-old William Falkingham heard something from police not too many people will ever hear. Stop wearing your bunny suit in public. Police investigated Falkingham after neighbors reported him as a public nuisance for frightening children in their neighborhood. One woman reported that her son had been frightened by Falkingham wearing a black bunny suit and hiding behind a tree and pointing his finger like a gun at him. Other neighbors also expressed that they were greatly disturbed by Falkingham and his bunny suit and the fact that he occasionally wears a tutu with it. So the bunny suit wasn't the problem, but the tutu was over the edge. Is that... Anyway. Falkingham stated that he enjoys wearing the suit, but understood the neighbor's concerns. Okay. Wow. You can legally stop some person from wearing a bunny suit? Well, I guess the fashion police can. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest. Apparently, one man, identified only as a businessman from the Middle East, didn't get the memo that the world economy is in a recession. Our friend just purchased a custom Rolls-Royce Phantom that is trimmed out with 265 pounds of solid 18-karat gold. Even the RR logos in the wheels receive the royal gold treatment. Now, normally, a run-of-the-mill Rolls-Royce Phantom would set you back at about $450,000, not a cheap car at its base price. But this baby comes in at $8.1 million. That's right, $8,150,000. Along with the gold trim, our wealthy driver also gets a gigantic golden radiator grille that is designed to resemble a bank. with gold trading at almost $1,700 per ounce. The gold alone is worth nearly $7 million. But it's equally an investment in the owner's safety. The car can reportedly also withstand assaults from AK-47s, sniper rifles, and even hand grenades. Because let's face it, protection from an attack is a basic necessity when you're driving a moving metaphor for greed. You know, gold is also quite heavy. I shudder to think what his gas mileage is, not that he cares. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Tom Sito is an animator who has worked on such classics as The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and more. He is also the author of a couple of books on the topic of animation, Drawing the Line, The Untold Story of the Animation Unions from Bosco to Bart Simpson, and also Timing for Animation. Plus, he also has a great blog on historical facts. And Tom joins us on the line from California. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. I wanted to talk to you because it's funny. It was just in the news this past week with DreamWorks animation and the whole situation where studios are now coming up with their own animation departments after a while when there was a time when there was no animation department, it seemed to be. Is this a renaissance period for animation, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's been going on for a bit. Like when I started in animation in the mid-70s, things were pretty kind of dead. There was just a very little. There'd be like the one Disney film, you know, like Rescuers or Aristocats. And then there'd be one also film, you know, like there'd be, you know, Our Man Flintstone or something like that. And that was pretty much it for the year. And for the last few years, there's been like 20 feature film releases a year. And, you know, Japanese anime has exploded. You know, there's a whole culture of people that just love anime and manga and all the Japanese adventure stories. And, you know, it's the tie-in with games and then also primetime television. You know, I mean, I remember I was packing my bags to go to London to work on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And a good friend of mine named David Silverman was working for like this little company called Laser Media, and he told me, he said, yeah, I'm going to start work on Monday at this new company, and Matt Groening, the guy who does this little strip called Life in Hell in the LA Weekly, is going to do a sitcom for Fox, and it's going to be about this dysfunctional family. And I said, well, what's the name of it? And he says, The Simpsons. And I said, well, that doesn't sound funny. It's just a name, you know. It's like the Andersons or the Worthingtons, or, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, okay, I was wrong, you know. It turned out to be a pretty good show, you know. but before that, if you had said, you know, animation in the evening for adults, you know, studios would say you were crazy, that there is no such thing.
Isn't that part of the problem? I mean, if you go back to the origins of some of the animation, like the Chuck Jones days, the Bugs Bunnies. Those were trailers shown before movies. They weren't necessarily made for kids. And then Saturday morning TV came along, and suddenly everyone thought cartoons are only for children. Was that part of the problem?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was that huge baby boom generation was raised on animation in the 1950s and 60s, and it just got this attitude of that animation was just babysitter, you know, just baby food, and in other countries like in Japan and Europe and all, the graphic novel was considered just another part of literature, while in America it seemed you know, North America, you know, it all just seemed like, oh, it's just for kids. And that attitude has only recently finally sort of, you know, gone away. And I think it is because of this sort of modern surge of films and games and films made from games and Cowboys and Aliens, you know, like all these sort of things. It's all sort of, it's a different, much more different ball game now than it was 20 years ago.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction that you've written a couple of books. Drawing the Line is one and Timing for Animation is another. Who is your prime audience when you had the idea to write these books?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in history, and And I had an opportunity, or I was fortunate enough that when I began my career, a lot of golden age artists from the 30s and 40s were finishing their careers. And I had a chance to sort of, you know, ask them questions and, you know, grab their wrinkly knees and go, tell me your secrets, old man, tell me, you know. And I noticed that there was this very strong, undercurrent of residual anger from the big Disney strike of 1941. And all these famous animators and artists that I had idolized when I was young all fell on one side or the other. But yet when you read official literature about that time period, it's like, you know, Walt had a wonderful family and then a bunch of commies tried to spoil the fun and then World War II happened. And they just kind of gloss over it. And I thought, well, for the people who lived through this, it was the most important thing in their lives, was what side were you on during the strike? You know, and it wasn't just the Disney studio, because the Warner artists pitched in, and the MGM and the Walter Lantz people, and everybody, you know, had an opinion. And they kept these opinions to the grave, practically. I mean, in their 80s, you know, the Maurice Noble, who was the who created all the beautiful designs for the Roadrunner cartoons, wouldn't go have lunch with me at Disney's because he thought he'd run into Frank Thomas, the animator who created Captain Hook, because they were on opposite sides.
Wow, it's like the Hatfields and McCoys.
Yeah, and I just thought, what was this thing that caused such passion, you know, that caused such residual emotion that it was still affecting people, even when the principals who started the whole thing were dead? And the more I researched it, the more fascinating it became, and I saw this whole undercurrent of the business end of Hollywood animation. As the famous industry saying goes, it's not show art, it's show business.
Do you feel fortunate that you came along at a time when you had the opportunity to go back and talk to some people who were at the forefront and beginning of your industry?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. I mean, my mentor was a fellow named Seamus Culhane. And Seamus had been one of the animators on the Hi-Ho March in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And he worked on Pinocchio. And he basically got started in silent film. So there's a connection right there from, like, you know, silent film directly to the present day. And he lived long enough to go over to the New York Institute of Technology in the late 70s, where there was a young engineer named Ed Catmull and his crew who were trying to create the first CG animation. Catmull today is the president of Pixar and the chairman of the Walt Disney Walt Disney Studios.
Were you one of those kids who was always drawing?
Oh yeah. When I was a child, I mean, my father was a fireman, my mother was a housewife, and you know, as I was a toddler, you know, I used to draw on the insides of books and on magazines, and you know, my parents would go, "Uh-oh, we've got an artist. Get him some paper," you know.
Now, you mentioned you have a love for history, and that's the other thing I want to talk about. We have a few minutes. You also, as I said in the introduction, have a great blog with historical facts. And what made you create that blog, which you do literally every day, this date in history kind of thing, which you also email as a newsletter, and I'm lucky enough to get every day, and it's great stuff. What made you do that?
You know, I've always been kind of fascinated by it. Part of my business as an artist, as an animator, is storytelling. And I've done a lot of story work in the movies, and I've written screenplays and all. And you discover with history that there's a fine line between storytelling and being a historian. It's how you arrange the events and the facts. And, you know, the earliest historians, when you get back to, you know, Homer and the Icelandic skalds and the Celtic singers, you know, basically were storytellers as they were telling the stories of heroes. And so I've always been fascinated by nonfiction, and the more nonfiction I would read, the more regular fiction didn't seem as interesting to me. And I always like history that has a little personality into it, you know, that has a little something that makes the people in the past come out to be more than just plaster statues.
People can go to your website, I believe, which is tomcito.com, correct?
Yes, they can.
And it's Cito is Cito, and they can check out the This Date in History each and every day if they'd like. Can you tell us what you're working on these days?
Well, see, these days I've been teaching at the University of Southern California in the film school, and as well as I'm working helping out Rob Minkoff, who's the director of he did the Stuart Little movies, and we're starting a new picture project, which I don't know if I'm allowed to say yet, but because it's still in the earliest stages. But and I'm completing a new history book as well, which is going to be a history of computer graphics from the 1940s.
Wow. Now, you say you teach. Do you feel that animation, the future of animation is in some good hands? Do you find that the kids you're teaching are as hungry to learn and work in the business and enjoy the craft like you did?
Yes, I think so. I am very impressed with the passion of younger students and their desire to want to learn animation. And, you know, one of the things that I was impressed by when I began in my career was how some of the older Golden Age artists were very giving and open with their experiences. And they taught us these things not just because they liked us as people, but they wanted to make sure that their traditions and their skills as artists moved on into the next generation. So I really see it as like a pay it forward thing. That I'm telling the students what I was taught by by Chuck Jones and by the artists of Snow White, and I'm hoping that they're taking my skills, the way I gave it to them, and they're passing it forward into another generation. Because the thing is, no matter how computerized things become, and no matter how the technologies change, the same performance skills to do with animation hold true. You know, I mean, the armies of orcs and Lord of the Rings are moving with the same principles that move Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse.
Mm. So you're handing it forward and passing it on to the next generation. It's sort of like 6 degrees of separation from Chuck Jones.
Yeah, exactly. I used to know Chuck really well. And it's funny because I talk to students now and I tell them I knew Chuck Jones, and they look at me like I knew Lincoln, you know. I said, no, he was a real person once. He was around.
Tom, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I should mention that website again, which is tomcito.com, and Cito is spelled S-I-T-O, correct?
Yes. And my book, CG, A Popular History of Computer Animation, should be out next year for University of Kentucky Press.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you so much.
Animator Tom Cito, author of Drawing the Line, The Untold Story of the Animation Unions from Bosco to Bart Simpson, and Timing for Animation. Again, you can visit his website at tomcito.com, and Cito is spelled S-I-T-O. You can also go to my site, that's thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0103, and you'll find links to Tom's site and also links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Over the years, I've had the chance to meet inventors whose creations have greatly improved our lives. One of my favorite inventors is Al Temi. His three-wheeled motorized scooter became known as the Amigo, and now you'll often see one when you walk into a large store. Before Al invented the Amigo, elderly and disabled people were often confined to wheelchairs that many felt were too hard to get around in. Today, Amigo Mobility International is one of America's great success stories. Their famous customers have included violinist Itzhak Perlman, Kentucky Fried Chicken founder Colonel Sanders, and even comedian Richard Pryor. Let's be fair, though, even a company that attracts celebrities as customers is not immune to frivolous lawsuits. Recently, I interviewed the CEO of Amigo, Beth Temi, about America's litigation problem, and our conversation is part of a new video program called The Story Behind Wacky Warning Labels. It's now airing on national TV. If you'd like to see it, you can also find it on our website at centerforamerica.org.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Jeffrey Gurian, who's a comic and a dentist. Or is he a dentist who's a comic? We'll also have an idiot of the day, and of course, lots more Stuff File news right here, right now. Arthur Zukas is the eccentric mayor of Lithuania's capital, Vilnius, and he's getting tough on crime. Well, one specific crime, anyway. People who park their cars illegally. Mayor Zukas has been filmed using an armored tank to roll over and crush a car parked illegally in a bicycle lane. Zuka says that's what'll happen if you park your car illegally. On the video, the apparent owner then arrives to see his wrecked Mercedes being towed away. Zuka adds, "What should the city do about drivers who think they are above the law? It seems that a tank is the best solution." Wow, you've really gone through all the other possibilities before you went the tank route. Anyway, the stunt was shot for the popular Swedish TV series 99 Things You Should Do Before You Die and has been posted on YouTube. In the video, Mayor Zukas ticks off the car's owner, sweeps up the broken glass from the wreckage, and then hops on a bicycle and rides away. And yes, I have put a link to the video if you want to see it. It's on my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the show number for this show, which is show number 0103, and you'll find it. And speaking of elected officials, the mayor of Sunland Park, New Mexico, he's a fellow by the name of Martin Resendiz, is trying to get out of 9 contracts he signed with a California company because he said he was drunk at the time he signed them. Also, a congressional candidate, Resendiz, says, "The day I signed, I had way too much to drink. It was after 5 p.m. and I didn't know what I was signing." Lawyers for the architectural design firm Synthesis Plus are now suing the tiny border town for $1 million. The mayor is a former El Paso, Texas police officer and Sunland Park municipal judge and has been a mayor since March of 2008 and has said he plans to seek the Democratic nomination to challenge Republican U.S. Representative Steve Pierce. Not quite sure how much of this will help his campaign. Anyway, attorney Victor Poulos, representing the architect, said it's the first time in his 33 years of practicing law that someone has acknowledged signing a contract while drunk. I guess it's in your best political advantage to get all your skeletons out of the closet way in advance. So kudos to you, Mayor. And elsewhere, who knew? The streets of 47th Street are literally paved with gold, said one of New York City's gold wranglers as he got down on all fours and was manipulating tweezers and picking specks of gold, silver, and jewels that had fallen off of clothing and jewelry racks as they were being rolled from trucks into stores. The man told the New York Post in June that he had recently earned $819 in redemptions for 6 days of prospecting. Now that is the entrepreneurial spirit. Okay, let's get to our last guest on this week's edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Jeffrey Gurian is a very funny man. He's also a dentist. Luckily for us, he has pursued a life in comedy rather than dentistry. He's been coming to Montreal every year for the Just for Laughs Festival, a festival that I've worked for and with for the last 20 years. It's always a pleasure to touch base with Jeffrey. We caught up with each other at Ground Zero for the festival. That is the Hyatt Hotel in Montreal, where you'll find all the comedy celebs hanging out. Here's that chat that we had right now. Jeffrey, it's been years we've been seeing each other at Jester Last
20 years, man. 20 years. We're friends. Yeah, I remember like in the early days when I'd come up here. And it's like, well, first, just any time, just seeing Peter Anthony Holder, I'm like, I feel like I'm home when I'm in Montreal, you know, just because that's how it is, man. We did so much stuff in the early days. It's got to be 20 years, right?
20 years, yeah.
Yeah, and you would always interview me on the radio and we'd talk about stuff. We had a lot of fun. And 20 years later, we're still happening, man.
Now, let's go back a little bit for the benefit of our new audience on the online show. And that is, when I first met you, you were a dentist who dabbled in comedy. Now you're sort of like a comedian who dabbles in dentistry.
Exactly. Well, I couldn't get a day job as a waiter, so I went to dental school, you know, which was so bizarre. And, you know, actually, the whole dental thing was just a rumor. And, you know, do you know when that rumor started?
When?
The day I graduated from dental school. And it hasn't stopped since. It's the bane of my existence. People keep accusing me of being a dentist. The truth is, you know, it's funny. I did an interview today with Ken Jeong from The Hangover and Community.
Community, yeah.
And he was a physician who gave that up to do this full time, you know, this comedy thing. And at the end of the interview, I said, I have to confess something to you that I don't tell many people, that I'm a doctor also. And he got a kick out of it. It's like, because he didn't used to be funny with his patients either. You know, there's a tendency, you never want your patients to think that you're not paying attention to what you're doing, that you're joking around. So you tend to be very serious. And he was the same way as me. He was afraid that his patients would find out.
Well, what is it about the lure of comedy? And I bring this up because again, you're a person, went through school, a whole education. I'm sure your parents are very, very happy.
No, my parents forced me into show business. They said, no son of ours will be a doctor. Don't shame us that way. They were typical Jewish parents. They said, and I had to hide in my room doing homework. They said, are you studying in there? Get out here and do comedy. And it was horrible. What a horrible existence. No, my parents were very proud. Absolutely very, very proud. And I'm sorry that I jumped in on your question. What were you going
to
ask?
No, the question basically is, you know, you make that commitment to do something. But what is it about comedy? Because it kind of gets into your system and doesn't let you go, even though you've made this choice, you've made this path, the career to go into dentistry. Comedy keeps, like the mob, pulling you back in.
Comedy is a drug. I always say everybody's life would be a lot simpler if they weren't in show business. Because then you just go out and you do what you do, you know. But if you have this drive to perform, no matter what it is, you can only suppress it for so many years. And then eventually you have to go and do it. And so I was writing for a long time. While I was in practice, I was writing for Joan Rivers and Rodney Dangerfield and for the Friars Roast and for legends like Milton Berle and Henny Youngman and people like that and Jerry Lewis. And they would call me at the office, and my nurse knew, only interrupt me when there is someone in show business on the phone. So she would come in, she'd say, Dr. Rivers is calling, you know. Dr. Lewis is on the phone for you. The only one that no one believed was Dr. Dangerfield. No one ever believed there was a Dr. Dangerfield. But that's what used to happen. And she would, you know, I would have a practice, and I was a cosmetic dentist. And I wrote comedy for a lot of big stars because I always geared myself towards writing for big stars, because otherwise it would sound like he has a knife-throwing act, he spins plates. Like I sound like an Ed Sullivan Show thing. He does dentistry. So I figured if you're going to be taken seriously in the industry, you should write for very famous people. And that I was lucky that I was able to meet them and wind up writing for them.
Now, you still do dabble in dentistry. I understand that you don't practice, but you teach.
I teach. I'm a professor at NYU in oral medicine and oral facial pain. Anything oral is my trip. And two mornings a week. And that keeps me, and radiology, that keeps me in touch with the profession. Because you're right, when you go to school all those years, you can't just walk away from that. But I haven't practiced in many years. I enjoy teaching students how to diagnose things and, you know, how to look at x-rays and what to look for on an x-ray. And that, for me, is fun.
Is there a commonality between being in front of students teaching and being in front of an audience with comedy?
Only that you have to have a lot of confidence to do both. I mean, stand-up comedy is the hardest thing in the world. I just started performing again fairly recently. Just because so many people told me that I should. I was out in L.A., about 2 weeks ago, I went out to interview Billy Crystal for this book that I'm doing, and also to interview Russell Peters, who's here at the festival. And I was performing. I did Kevin Nealon's show at the Laugh Factory. He does a great show where you perform, and then you sit on stage, and he interviews you. And I got the call that I was supposed to go on third that night. So I walk into the club. It's an 8 o'clock show. I'm due 8:40. Kevin's on stage, he's warming up the audience. I hadn't seen him in years. And he says to the audience, we got a great show for you tonight. Let me see who's on the roster. And he starts to read names, and I'm third. He goes, Jeffrey Gurian. Is Jeffrey Gurian here? And I'm in the back of the room, and I'm like, yeah, I couldn't say no. I'm here. And he's like, let's bring Jeffrey Gurian up first.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, Kevin, I thought you liked me. And he brings me up first, and I killed it. I absolutely can. And Jamie Masato was in the room. I have to say that I did well, okay? Jamie Masato, who owns the club, was there. And he hadn't seen me perform because I hadn't performed in L.A. before. It was the first time on stage in L.A. And he's like, he passed me on the spot. He's like, anytime you want to perform here, you're welcome to perform in this club. It was a great experience. And then after you do the set, then you sit with Kevin and he interviews you for about 10 minutes. So that was very cool. And then I wound up doing a spot at the Improv on their Friday night 10 o'clock show, which was also very cool. And it was a great thing. But what I was saying was that you have to have confidence. You have to have confidence as a doctor, and you have to have a lot of confidence as a comedian.
What's the, you mentioned a book that you're working on. Tell us a little bit about that book.
There's a legendary comedy club in New York City called the Comic Strip. It opened on June 1st of 1976. The founder of the club is a guy named Richie Tinkin, and he had a partner, Bob Wax. They managed Eddie Murphy. They discovered Eddie Murphy and managed him for like 11 years. And they also discovered Chris Rock when Eddie found him in 1986, which is another interesting story that I'll tell you. So I'm doing the book on the 35-year history of the comic strip. And I've already interviewed about maybe 30 of the comedians, you know, Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Louis Black, Susie Essman, Larry Miller, George Wallace. They all came, Ray Romano. They all came out of that club in the early days, and they're all very loyal to the club. So I've interviewed them all. We're doing a documentary film as well, and Chris Rock is the exec producer of the film because he's very grateful to Richie Tinkin for his career. And that's why I went out to interview Billy Crystal. He was the first comic ever on stage at the comic strip. As a thank you to Bob Wax, Bob had been his attorney. And when the club opened, they wanted somebody spectacular to be on stage. And Billy Crystal was the first comic to ever set foot on stage there and for the Fort Lauderdale Club. They opened a club in Florida as well.
We just got a few more minutes, but I got to mention you have a great website. You do a lot of good work. And
well, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the website and the things that you do with that site and how people can find it.
Great. Okay. For the last 12 years, I've been writing a column called Comedy Matters. And it's an inside look at the comedy world. I'm here shooting stuff at the Just for Laughs festival. As a matter of fact, I interviewed Andy Nolman, the head of the festival, who said in his words, when I want to know what happened at the festival, I look at Jeffrey Gurian's column, Comedy Matters, because you sum it all up at the end, which was such an honor to me that Andy, I mean, he's been a friend for years, but that he supports the column. Your listeners can find it at my vlog at jeffreygurian.com/comedymatters. Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, Gurian, G-U-R-I-A-N is a Nancy, .com/comedymatters. And there must be like 50 films up there, all celebs talking about the comedy world, everybody that you'd want to see, you know, as Billy Crystal, Russell Peters, Paul Reiser, just, you know, all the big stars. And Paul Provenza, I just did a whole thing about, he debuted his new show, The Green Room, in New York. I postponed my trip to L.A. for one day so I could see Paul in New York. He wrote the foreword to my book. I did a book some years ago for the I wrote for the Friars Roast for many years. And they asked me to do a book of celebrities' favorite nasty jokes. So it's called Filthy, Funny, and Totally Offensive, with a foreword by Paul Provenza. And so I stayed and I did his show. Elisa Lampanelli was there. Everybody's in the column. And if you Google my name, even if they don't have that, it'll all come up. So I'm up for a television show. So hopefully by the next time I see you next year, God willing, right, that you'll be a guest on my television show.
I'd love it.
And I would love it too, man, because it's always great to see you.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for being with us. And I'm going to make sure I put the link in on the website at my show to so people can find out the stuff that you're doing. And that's jeffreygurian.com/comedymatters.
jeffreygurian.com/comedymatters.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Peter. Great to see you as always.
Comic Jeffrey Gurian. He's definitely a renaissance man of comedy. You can check out his website at jeffreygurian.com. And for all those interviews he mentioned, check out jeffreygurian.com/comedymatters. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0103, and you'll find links to Jeffrey's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents
the Idiot of the Day.
In Portsmouth, England, 21-year-old Jonathan Ochola has been identified as a suspect in an armed robbery, but insisted to police that he had been home watching football with his brother at the time. Police had traced the robbers to an apartment after one had dropped a balaclava, yes, a balaclava, with his DNA on it. At the apartment, police found Ochola's daytime calendar and had found written right on the date of the robbery, "Portsmouth robbery happens." Faced with the damning evidence, Ochola tried to blame it on his friend, but that didn't carry him very far. He and his accomplice were both arrested. Now, why would someone need to write in their agenda that they were planning a robbery on that date? Is there some other pressing issue on their schedule that date that would take precedence? I doubt it. I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say, He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0103. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0103. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for show number 0103. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.